come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be Elise Kuznets, who is the author of the new collection of poems, Small Hours. It is the 2014 T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize winner, and it's a fantastic book, so you're not going to want to miss this. She is fantastic. And as I was reading her book, I noticed she uses a lot of images from fairy tales. She talks about Jack and the Beanstalk, and she evokes the Match Girl. Oh, I don't know if you remember Hans Christian Andersen's The Match Girl, but when I was a kid, that story just broke my heart. I remember that little Match Girl lighting the matches to keep warm, and she just keeps lighting the matches until she runs out of matches and has to walk right into heaven. Oh, it broke my heart. But you know, one of the pleasurable things about being a writer, especially after, you know, I'm kind of mature. I've been teaching at the university level for many years. I teach literature courses. I read a lot. I dabble in physics for the layperson. I dabble in mysticism, a little bit of Kabbalah here and there, a little bit of Swedenborg. And one of the things that I really love doing is going back to fairy tales that used to blow me away when I was a kid. Not just fairy tales, but books in general. My favorite book when I was a kid was The Star-Bellied Sneetches by Dr. Seuss. I love going back to that book now. And I see these images, and I realize that children's literature, at least the kind that's going to last from generation to generation, fairy tales and the like, are laden with these incredibly powerful archetypes, these images that have these recurring symbols and motifs in literature. They are all over. They are populating the landscape of fairy tales, like Little Red Riding Hood, for example. Little Red Riding Hood, if you read it as an adult, has a lot more meaning than when you read it as a kid. As a kid, you're reading a wolf just wanting food. As an adult, you see the other sexual political implications of the wolf following Little Red Riding Hood to grandmother's house and eating both grandmother and Little Red Riding Hood. And then, of course, the archetype of the hunter coming in and cutting him up to pieces and saving the mother and Little Red Riding Hood. And it reminds me of what I heard one time about the way Disney writes scripts for movies. When you are an adult and you enter into a Disney movie, like I did this weekend, I went to go see Into the Woods, which is with Meryl Streep, and it is essentially a mixture of all these different fairy tales that they bring together, Jack and the Beanstalk, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella. If you go into these movies, you watch these movies, these Disney movies as an adult, you're going to get a lot of subtextual things. You're going to get a lot of subtleties. You're even going to get some sexual politics going on between two actors, between two characters. You're going to understand the dialogue on multiple levels. Whereas if you go into it as a kid, you're just going to understand the story. You're going to be fascinated and wide-eyed. So the script satisfies two audiences, an audience with an education and an audience that is just fascinated by the images and fascinated by the monsters and the special effects. And I think that's a good lesson to learn as writers. And I think that as writers, when we create a work of art that requires our readers to have a certain historical or political or social knowledge in order to understand it, and if they don't understand it, we say, well, I guess if you were a little more educated, you would understand my work. If we are writing stuff like that, I think we're hack writers. I think our work should work on multiple levels. You shouldn't have to understand the philosophical and intellectual implications of a work of art in order to access and to respond on a fundamental emotional level. And I think one of the ways that we do that as writers is to always remember the child. Always remember that little kid that we are, because when we think about what it was like as children, we used our imagination. We always sought an imaginative world, and we didn't care about facts. We didn't care about ideas. All we cared about was the imagination, and I think we need to retain that as artists. We need to retain that imagination of a child. Stephen King was once asked, where do you get your ideas? They're so imaginative. Where do you get your imagination? And he says, I have the heart of a little boy in a jar on my desk. Of course, he's a little macabre, but he's right. You got to have the heart of a little boy. You got to have the heart of a little girl and the intellect of an adult, I think, when you want to create good art. And speaking of good art, Small Hours is a fantastic book that does just that. It blends the innocent with the intellect. And I think you're going to like this book. So stick around and we'll talk to Elise Kuznets. Elise Kuznets' first book of poems, Small Hours, is the 2014 T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize. She earned an M.A. in creative writing from Syracuse University and a Ph.D. in contemporary feminist and postcolonial British literature from the University of Edinburgh. Her poetry has appeared in Crab Orchard Review, The Cincinnati Review, Crazy Horse, Stone Canoe, Rattle, and other journals and anthologies. Elise, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on this new book of poems called Small Hours. I've been dipping into it all week, and it's fantastic. It's beautiful. And it won the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And Dorianne Locks was the judge for this one. We had her on the show. She is a fantastic poet. And, you know, a lot of people don't know how these poetry prizes work. They might think, well, Dorianne Locks is the judge, so she's going to read absolutely every manuscript that is sent. But I imagine this prize, like most of them, gets thousands of manuscripts. And it's only the finalists that get past the committee that make it to Dorianne Locks. Where were you when you found out about it, and how did you feel?
I was at home. It was winter break, and I got the phone call, and You never expect the phone call, so
yeah.
You pick up the phone just thinking, what's that strange number, you know, that I don't know, should I let it go to voicemail, and then you think, no, better not, you know, just in case. And it was Nancy Rediger, who was the head of the press at that time, and she said, I'd like to congratulate you, I'm calling to tell you that you won the T.S. Eliot Prize, and the shock washes over you, and you're just incredibly grateful, and you just really actually don't believe it. You know, you think in the back of your mind, you're like, is this a prank phone call? Is somebody pranking me?
You know, I think sometimes I tend towards the opposite when I don't win a prize and I hear who the winner is. I go, well, maybe they made a mistake.
Right. So, right. It was a typo.
I have a statistic that I'm completely making up, but a contest to win a literary contest, you're just as likely to get hit by lightning. Because, I mean, it is a really incredibly difficult thing to achieve.
In that case, come and live in Florida because it's a lot more likely that you'll be struck by lightning here.
Awesome. But yeah, that's just congratulations for winning this prize. And it's a darn good one.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, I was just so pleased. And there's a great sense of relief that comes from knowing that finally the very private efforts that you're making, you know, in the small hours of the night, you know, to write these poems and to get your vision down on paper is finally going to go public. And then there's other work to be done, you know, to draw out what's in the book and to share it with a larger audience. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the press and what they told me that had drawn them to the book was the sense of history that's in the book. And I appreciated that they seemed to really tap into what I was trying to say in many cases, not just about history, but that was one of the things that they had mentioned. And I felt this extreme sense of gratitude, you know, that vision was in a place where it was going to be fostered, because that to me is at the heart of the book. People ask me, you know, why is there so much history in this book? Mm-hmm. And I tell them that, you know, there's a lot of different ways I think that history can be used and by an artist, you know. And, of course, there's my family history in there and a little bit of how that family or personal history intersects with the larger cultural, historical events such as World War II, directly or indirectly, you know. But I think that for me as an author, you know, that idea, that vision of history goes a lot further, too. You know, we live in a time that I think we need to look back to history to understand what's happening now. You know, it's a reflection in many cases of our own time. and can provide us with metaphors for what's happening now, you know, these larger cultural issues that we're struggling with. If we examine history, you know, and an examination of that history, it is a way to try and make sense of the present, but also to try and reconstruct what has been, you know, lost to us over time, you know, what has been buried.
For example, you have several poems on Hitler. And
yes.
And that really kind of struck me, because the image of Hitler in your book is not just historical. I mean, you don't need to have an historical context in order to understand the poem. The poem itself creates its own metaphorical possibilities with the image of Hitler, for example, as a painter, or Hitler, that one poem, I forget the name of it, where waiting at a train station.
Oh, there's a Bridget Hitler's memoirs where his sister-in-law, and she's living over in Liverpool, and a young Hitler comes to visit them.
Yeah, and were you consciously allowing the poem to work on multiple levels? Here's the historical context, but if you don't know the history, the poem is going to function in this way?
Oh, yeah, I think, you know, you have to hope that the poem's going to stand by itself. There are stories in history that are fascinating in and of themselves, and, you know, we're drawn to these historical figures for a reason. You know, Hitler was a failed artist, and he became the most terrible, awful tyrant. You know, he's sort of the epitome of evil, you know, and what he did and how he felt about the Jews and the events he set in motion that caused the deaths of millions and millions of people. You know, that kind of thing, those historical figures and their stories are interesting in and of themselves. They're tragic, too. But they cause these events where, you know, like I was saying, you have to look at them and try and reconstruct them, because there are these people who and cultures that have been annihilated and mm-hmm. erased, you know, either in the course of the war by these powers that be who just are so intent on proving their superiority. For the Nazis, it's, you know, the Aryan ideal. But, you know, there are plenty of cultures, and even today, where there's a sense of superiority and entitlement and a victimization of certain groups of people, certain populations, that if you victimize the other, if you victimize those who seem different than us, you can maintain a sense of superiority, maintain control, you know, and just crush everyone who stands in the way of that. That happens in history, and it happens around us today. So that the parallels just kept emerging between historical times and events and what's happening now in our own culture and around the world. So I think, yes, those different levels, it was really important for me to write about these things, because they just screamed to be not only stories in and of themselves, but warnings, you know, and red flags.
In a sense, do you feel like it's the poet's responsibility to have a social political voice?
I think that's part of poet's responsibility. That idea of bearing witness is very important, not just large social events and more personal events. Maybe it's our job, in a sense, to swallow that history and sift through it in a very visceral way, looking for truths or looking for some form of redemption, you know. I mean, right. There are things that cannot be redeemed, but I think it's our job to look for those moments when even the telling of stories, the sharing of tragedy, can give us some sense of redemption, because we have borne witness. We have said, you know, pay attention. And these things are things that can happen again. They can always happen again. People say, oh, that can't happen again. But I don't think that's true. I think that the minute we start thinking it can't happen again is the minute the seed is born where it actually can. You know, I look at what a lot of corporations are doing, and I don't know how it'll come out, maybe in my next book. You know, the idea that, you know, we have Occupy, we had Occupy for such a long time in the streets, and that dissipated, and there was not a lot of social change that happened from that in this country, which was a little worrying, which shows you just how much control the very rich and very powerful have here.
Well, I'm talking to Elise Kuznets, author of Small Hours, which won the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry in 2014. You begin the book with The Match Girl, which I think is just a beautiful, beautiful poem. Why did you start with this poem, and how does it prepare the reader to enter into the world of this book?
Well, that poem, to me, was always a touchstone in the book. And it's interesting, that poem, I haven't had this experience very often, but when I was writing it, I felt very much like a voice was singing through me, and the poem was coming out. And I had to do some revision afterwards, but it came out mostly whole. And I had been reading about different situations where workers had died in the workplace and was really had been bothered about what was happening with the destruction of the unions and workers' rights in this country. And so I felt that somehow, you know, was connected to these larger historical patterns of abuse by those who are in power, abusing those who don't have that power. And so I felt like that was really one of the hearts of the book, that idea that there is this duality. And I wanted to somehow show that. So in the poem, there are the workers in the factories, the women who are being poisoned either by mercury or by things that cause cancer. And there was an emperor who thought that taking mercury would extend his life, would make him immortal. Mm-hmm. And the irony of that and the contrast of that kind of resulted in that poem and talking about, you know, people who are forgotten as opposed to the people who are remembered, and how essentially they're no different from each other. It's just that one set of those people had control of history and right. The events.
You're not that you can really summarize a poem any more than you can summarize a symphony, but the poem essentially deals with these young women who worked at a match factory. They made matches, and they would inhale the vapors, and it negatively affected their health. In fact, the last line, or one of the lines, that I think it's the last line in the poem, is their bodies burning like forbidden books, which I think is really a beautiful image. But you said that when you were writing this, that you kind of felt a voice that was there, that was kind of with you. Do you remember the Hans Christian Andersen version of The Match Girl?
Yeah.
It was such a beautiful story, this little match girl who was selling matches, and she was very cold. And even though this poem doesn't really have anything to do, per se, with that.
No, the title references that, definitely.
Yeah, it evokes it so much. And are you able to go back to images in literature that you encountered as a child and see the archetypal possibilities for your poetry now?
Oh, sure. As a child, I was fascinated by fairy tales and mythology, and that fascination carries through. But, you know, as a child, I was also fascinated by technology and science, and I was a total nerd. I watched Star Trek and Star Wars, and for me, these are also my mythologies. You know, I was always very future oriented at the same time as I was fascinated by the past, you know. So maybe I feel very pushed and pulled between these two things, you know, needing to look at the past but longing for the future.
In your poem Letter to Scientists, you have this line or this passage, I'm going to read it. You say, "Dirac, what can I say? If gravity does decrease as the universe ages, bit by bit will unmoor from the earth." And that's a lovely image. And I'm wondering, the humor, it kind of reminds me of, I wouldn't want people to get the impression that your book is all these serious issues that, you know, and about oppression and about injustice, although it is. But like a good Shakespeare play, there is comic relief. And these humorous poems kind of give us a relief from that pain. When you put this book together, did you consciously give us that relief with these humorous poems? Or
sure. You know, for me, my philosophy is if you don't laugh, you're going to cry. And so I have to see, you know, a lot of times the irony in things and the humor in things. And there's so much humor in the world. And there's not just tragedy. There's not just the bad that happens. There's the good. There's so much that's across the spectrum of humor, you know, from giggly humor to kind of dark humor, ironic humor. And those poems that are more humorous in tone or just capture the joke is because, you know, life is funny too. And there has to be balance. And I'm someone who sees the world very ironically, I think. And if there's humor in a situation, you know, maybe it's our job as poets and artists to find that too. You know, I can't help it. I you know, like I said, if you don't laugh, you cry. And you can't cry all the time.
Right,
so,
right.
yeah, very, very much so. I think that our sense of humor is one of the things that really keeps us alive.
You have a PhD in contemporary feminist and postcolonial British literature from the University of Edinburgh. And I imagine that the subject matters you encountered must have had, you know, a profound effect on the way you see the world, or perhaps a better way of saying it is, as you're developing in your ways of seeing, it contributed, I'm sure, to some moments of clarity. How has that kind of study affected your poetics, your aesthetic?
You know, if you're a woman, and even if you're not, you have to see that there's been a history where women have been disenfranchised for a very long time and have had many battles to fight. I remember my mother going back to school to get her master's degree in the 70s and really blossoming into another career as, you know, until I guess the early 70s, you couldn't even apply for a credit card if you were a woman. You had to have the permission of your father or your husband. And that's not that long ago, you know. Just as computers are on the track to 10 years later, we have a personal computer. But 10 years before that, we are just barely having a time when a woman can apply for a credit card by herself, you know, to put that into perspective. And I think that the other thing that with postcolonial theory, you know, confirming a lot of, I think, what I already believe, but then had a framework for talking about that, you know, there are imperial powers, America is an imperial power, and there are powers, you know, countries, nation states, you know, even the construction of a nation state being something, you know, thrust upon a territory, which then becomes colonized by a more powerful entity, and what happens to the people who live there first. What happened to the Native Americans in our own country who are now put on strange squares of land called reservations, you know. It's a way of seeing the world, and I think it's a really important way of seeing the world, both a feminist perspective and a postcolonial perspective. They're very complex ideas, you know. It's not just one thing. I'm very, I think you can probably tell by now that one of the things that's most important to me is to not simplify things. You know, there are some very important things that feel very simple that I do think we can, you know, hold on to. The idea of love at its heart, although love can be very complex. You know, I recently got a little bit into Zen Buddhism, you know, and the idea of simplicity is very important there. But most ideas and most things that we have to encounter have a complexity that if we don't try and truly understand, we're going to do a disservice to the world. But the most important thing I think about postcolonial theory for me was this idea that what is the aftermath of having been colonized, not just for the people who have been colonized, but for the people who are in the culture that did the colonizing. How do you then begin to approach this idea of the other, the idea of people who seem different from us? That's something that doesn't just affect people who are in colonized countries, but who are in America, you know, the idea of the other, the idea of people who seem different than us, whether you look at something like what happened in Ferguson, or you look at Charlie Hebdo and extremism versus, you know, say a Muslim person who is just wanting to go about their business, who doesn't have anything in common with those extremists, but who becomes a target because of their religion, you know, because we don't understand a lot of the time. A large percentage of this country doesn't understand that not all people are the same, you know.
Right.
We have a problem dealing with things that seem different from us.
what's wonderful about this book is that you could read it and enjoy the poems simply on the level of language and image and enjambment and all the wonderful things that we love about poetry. But the more you read it, the more you can uncover other layers of, you know, multiple parallel meanings. And so thank you so much, Elise. Can you, would you do us a favor and would you read one of the poems from the book?
Sure. How about if I read Match Girls?
I'd love it.
Match Girls. In the factories of America during the 19th century, girls hired to make matches would dip the match ends into a chemical vat, then lit the tips to make them stiff. Phosphorus vapor filled the air, a poison about which no one warned them. So when their teeth fell out and their jaws rotted like bad fruit, it was too late. It was not the first time such things happened. Bent at their workstations, women in the 18th century cured ladies' hats with mercury. Their legacy, blushing, aching limbs, a plague of rashes, parchment-thin pages of sloughed skin, curled and cracked, minds deranged. They could not know they shared a fate with Emperor Qin Shi Huang, who, seeking eternal life, swallowed pills laced with mercury. He built the Great Wall and unified China, then outlawed all religions not sanctioned by the state, burned treatises on history, politics, and art. Scholars who dared possess such things, he buried alive. His body lies in a vast mausoleum, guarded by a terracotta army. Of the factory girls, mouths opening below earth, their bodies burning like forbidden books, we know almost nothing.
That was Elise Kuznets reading Match Girl, the opening poem of Small Hours. Thank you, Elise, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
I'd like to thank Elise Kuznets for joining us on Words on a Wire. She joined us from Orlando. Maybe we could move our studios to Florida. Norma, I'm asking the producer right now. She's shaking her head. I think she likes the idea. Thank you. Join us every week on Words on a Wire. Thank you, Norma, for the wonderful job that you do and making us sound good. And don't forget, the next book you read should be a fairy tale.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head.